to go beyond and into your authentic self, into your true nature, into your highest expression of who you are. So in this way, we can actually start to look at fear, when it's emotional fear, as being that guide. This is how I think about it. I think when I have an emotional fear, like let's say something simple, it's not exactly fear, but sometimes if I'm going to do a personal growth workshop where I'm going to participate, I have a little resistance to that. And I would think that when I have that resistance come up, I start to think I should follow that resistance. You feel like you don't want to do this, so you need to do this, Chris. That's what I tell myself. Well, emotional fear is the same thing. A lot of people have the fear of public speaking, for example. That's an emotional fear. You can think of that as the hoop of fire. But if you can break through that hoop of fire and on the other side, the gift, the other side of fear, as you lean into it, is that as you move through that fear, you come into being a public speaker or whatever, then you're able to express from this very authentic place, from outside of your fear. I mean, really, what is there to be scared of? I mean, you could be teaching some sort of workshop or something on mindfulness. How is that scary? So if you start to think of our fears as just something to move through, lean into, and actually be your guide, you'll start to feel almost excited when you feel that sense of fear, not scared anymore, because it's telling you you're out of your comfort zone. And that's a really good thing, to be out of your comfort zone. It means you're stretching yourself. So your greatest fear may have been something like mine was, which initially was being alone. But you know what? You don't have to be alone in loss. Nobody said you have to be alone. There's no rules in loss. You can do loss the way you do it. You can design your own plan. You can lean into loving again after heartbreak or not. This is your choice. But I will say this, that a lot of people will immediately try and fill that hole, that gaping hole of loss of any kind with something else. And I'm going to encourage you to think of filling that hole with nothing but the present moment. Don't go right out if you've gotten divorced or you're in loss from a loved one. Don't go right out and try and find somebody else to replace that person. You know, spend some time with yourself and spend some time in reflection. So I'm going to share a story about a woman named Karen, and she came to one of my heartbroken open circles. I used to have these circles in my home where we invite people that were going through loss, and a lot of women were divorced or they had lost their spouse, and they would come to my home and we'd sit in circle together. And when Karen first came, she was really, you know, understandably a mess, and she just lost her husband to a train accident. Very, very tragic accident. And I listened to her. We all listened to her. She left. And then one day I was at the supermarket and Karen ran up to me, but I didn't recognize it was Karen. She was glowing. She looked so different a few short months later. And she said, Chris, I have something to tell you. And I said, what's that? She said, your advice really worked. And I thought, uh-oh, well, what advice was that? So what did I tell you? And she said, you told me that if I needed to, I could find a companion and I didn't have to go right out and fall in love. I didn't have to address my fear in that way, but I could find a healing companion, and that I should just think of it that way, as a healing companion. I shouldn't think of it and turn it into something else. She said, well, I've done that and it's really, really helped me. I'm still going through grief. I'm still in loss, but I'm not alone. See, this is your choice. You don't have to be alone going through loss. Nobody should be alone. But you don't have to run out and have anybody take the place of your loved one either. That's purely up to you. But if we don't address our fears and we allow our fears to create that block, that can be a true barrier. It can really put us in a place of waiting. It can make us feel like we're dangling in this place. It can stop our healing. in this place of waiting where we're not here and we're not there. So when you've leaned into your fears and healed, this one question can become your guide to a new dream. Something new is going to emerge from you as you open, as you heal, and your adventure begins, and you get to choose to have a great love affair with your life. This one question will lead you on this love affair, and that is, what is your deepest desire and passion? Follow that. So the other side of release and letting go is receive. Remember that mantra, that star mantra? It's rebirthing a new life and a new dream. There is this time when you feel better, and it's different for everyone. I remember wondering, when is this grief thing going to be done? Sometimes you just wonder how much of it you're going to endure or you can endure. There's no real timeline for anyone. But I remember about 2 years in, I came in late one night. I was out with some girlfriends and I didn't think about it. And I, for the first night in a long time, I slept all night long. And when I woke up the next morning, I felt different. I felt better. I felt like myself again. And you know what? I woke up on Richard's side of the bed. I had gone to sleep on Richard's side of the bed for the first time in 25 years. And I felt better. And that's what I'm saying to you, is you just don't know when you're going to suddenly be out or when you're going to feel better. And I'm not saying that you're going to be completely out, but boy, I'll take feeling better over being in deep grief any day. And it feels a little bit like when you've had the flu or something, you know how you're laying on the floor and you think, I just want to die right now. And suddenly you feel better. And boy, you want that steak or you want to go eat something really good. Well, this is the time that this happens. You know, when you have accepted this change, when you have released a lot of emotion and feelings, you do receive this new life. And there's this just delightful sense of awareness that comes in this awakened heart state that you have well earned. You feel so much more alive in everything. You know, you go outside and you feel the breeze on your face. You smell smells you've never smelled. Things that in your other life were completely invisible to you are suddenly profoundly alive to you. It's an amazing thing because you are awake to life. This profound awakening is a true engagement in the present moment. You are living way more presently than you ever have. And that's what loss, that's what heartbreak can really teach us. It can bring us right into mindfulness. It can bring us right into the present moment. You are seeing the ordinary as extraordinary. That's the Don't Sweat the Small Stuff chapter. That's one I understand really well. All the ordinary things become extraordinary. So I am always reminded when I talk about this of Joseph Campbell and this wonderful interview that I watched on this documentary that he did with Bill Moyers. And I remember Joseph Campbell saying and exploding, actually, you know, by God, I'm suffering, but by God, I'm alive. I just love that because that's the truth, isn't it? Yeah, you're suffering, but you're feeling and you're feeling alive. And this is what the journey is. This is what embracing the journey means. It means that we're really bracing and embracing more life. So now I'm going to talk about recovery, rediscovery, and discovery, because as you heal and you begin to see this new life is coming, this is a great opportunity to discover who you are now. So when your identity is shattered, but you can take a look back to see what you left behind, those aspects, those passions, that self-expression. Remember when you were 5 years old and somebody asked you, what did you want to be when you grew up? Well, they asked you, what did you want to be when you grow up? But you've grown up now. Think about those things that were just natural passions to you. Well, a lot of times what we find is that we've left those behind to live the life that we've lived. An identity crisis can be an opportunity to reclaim and rediscover those passions. Are those innate qualities, those things that have been left dormant in your career, dormant in your relationship, or whatever you've identified with so strongly that has overshadowed something else that has kept you from feeling whole? So what you have lost actually helps you discover what you value presently. And now that you see the world through a new agreement with reality and a new lens, who are you after this career, this breakup, this loss? What did you leave behind in the past to live the life that you've lived? Your dream shattered. Now is the time to dream again. Look to your passion. What excites you? What excites you, ignites you? That is for sure. What gives your life meaning now? 3 months before Richard died, he said to me something that came back to me time and time again as I was going through grief. He said, "You know, Chris, what I love most about the human spirit?" And I said, "What, honey?" And he said, "I love that there are people that take their greatest tragedy and allow it to move them forward in life so that their life has greater meaning than it might have otherwise had." Now, I'm not sure everything in life happens for a reason. I believe that it is our job to find the reason why things happen. Perhaps the greatest adventure of all is living in and open to the mystery of the unknown and allowing it to unfold. I've learned that the unknown is actually a really exciting place to live because it's so creative. It's not restricted by plans. It's not restricted by anything. But being present is the key that puts you in the flow. And in closing, I'd love to share a story with you that shows that there are miracle moments of grace in presence. When you are truly present and tuned into your deepest desire and you ask for something that serves all, you don't miss the nuances of spirit. And spirit delivers the answer to your prayer and your feelings guide you. So about 2 years after Richard's transition, my daughters and I were flying back home from Eugene to San Francisco. We had been visiting my parents and they'd had this 50th wedding anniversary party. And it was about Christmas time, a little bit before Christmas. And we walk up to the ticket agent at the airport and the ticket agent says to us, "Do you know you're not seated together on this flight?" And we look at each other and I ask the girls, "Does that matter?" And they say, "No, it doesn't matter." I say, "It's okay. We're okay. It's a short flight." It was a little commuter jet from flying from Eugene to San Francisco. And he takes it upon himself to rearrange our seats on this plane. And so he says, as we, you know, are walking away, he calls out and he said, "Oh, I got you seated together." And I was like, "Oh, great. Thanks." So we go and we get seated on the plane and the girls are in the window in the aisle and I'm seated in the aisle and the window seat is open and a man walks up to sit in the window seat. And I remember getting this really odd feeling come over me, super odd, almost a chill. I remember thinking, "Wow, that's a weird feeling I'm having." And my kids let out a giggle. Now they were 19 and 17 years old. I mean, they're not giggling age, you know, but they let out this giggle. And I thought, that's odd too. This guy sits down and I think to myself, I really want to talk to this guy. I really want to talk to him. But he pulls his laptop out and he starts to tap away and I'm like, okay, I'm not going to bug him. He's clearly working. So I quiet down and settle in my seat. And on the descent of the flight, about 45 minutes later, I still have that super strong feeling that I want to talk to this guy. So I ask him, "Hey, is this a work day for you?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, I'm really sorry. I would have loved to have chatted with you, but I have a meeting this afternoon." We talk about how he was visiting his sister and I was visiting my family. He says, what about you? Is it a work day for you? I notice you have your laptop with you. And I said, no, it's not a work day, but I'm a writer. And so potentially every day is a work day. I always take my laptop with me. And he said, oh, have you been published? Anything I might know of? And I said, well, possibly, but you'd probably be more aware of my late husband, Dr. Richard Carlson's work. He wrote Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. Well, the guy did something like this. He kind of sat back and he looked up and got a little uncomfortable. He even turned color a little bit, like he got very uncomfortable. And I said, what? Did you know him? And he shook his head. He said, no, I didn't know him. And I said, what? He said, well, did your husband die on a flight to JFK a little over 2 years ago? And I said, yeah, he did. How did you know he died going to JFK? And he said, because I was seated directly behind him on that flight. I was the first to assist. I helped to lift your husband's body out of his seat. You can imagine how that felt for me. And I said, what are the odds of that? And he said, there are no odds that this could happen. But what he didn't know was that my deepest prayer, the thing that I wanted more than anything in the world, was to meet somebody who had been on that plane with Richard, who had been holding space for him, who was with him when he died. So that meant everything to me, and that was such a miracle. And it was such a miracle of grace, and it also verified to me that when you're present, and you listen to your feelings, and when you're in the present moment, you don't miss the nuances of spirit. Nobody missed their cue that day. Not the guy that changed our seats. Not my daughters. And not me. That story marked the hugest pivot turn in my growth. And I'm so grateful to know that we are loved. And that we are divinely guided, and that when we're mindful and we're mindfully aware, it pays great dividends in our lives. Thank you so much for being here and listening. It's been a great honor to share this time with you.
Up next, mindfulness coach Juna Mustad will teach you to meet your anger and ask it how it can help you.
And so using mindfulness, which is really a tool to help us see clearly, we can better get to those gems of wisdom that our anger is trying to share with us.
Lecture 7, A Mindful Approach to Anger.
Juna Mustad is a highly developed mindfulness coach, author, and expert in mindful anger. She brings an unparalleled depth and nuance to her teaching. She works with Fortune 100 companies, organizations, and individuals all over the world, coaching them in emotional intelligence, mindfulness, and skills for building healthy and effective relationships.
Hello, my name is Juna. And I'm delighted to be here with you today as we explore a mindful approach to anger. And so to get us started, I just want to share one of my favorite quotes that kind of illustrates a little bit about what we're going to be doing today. And this quote is by Pema Chodron, and she's a world-famous meditation mindfulness teacher. Compassion is knowing our darkness well enough that we can sit in the dark with others. And so to me, this quote really signifies the importance of taking that time to get to know our own darkness, our own shadowy stuff, which includes our uncomfortable emotions like anger. And when we can do this, when we can generate compassion for ourselves and our own darkness, then we are better apt, better suited to offer this to other people, to be with them in their shadow. And this is how we love people. This is how we tend to those that we love, and this is a form of compassion. So this is really what we're going to be doing a little bit of today. So let's go ahead and get started. What we're going to be exploring is anger. And anger is one of the most stigmatized emotions out there. Anger gets a pretty bad rap in our society, in our world, in our religions, at home, with our families, in our schools. And in large part, anger gets a bad rap because of a lot of the things that are connected to it, violence, aggression. And so there's a lot of good reason that it gets this bad rap. But because it gets this stigma, we have not taken the time to truly get to know anger, to create a relationship with it. So when anger arises, which invariably it will because we're human and we have boundaries and sometimes we don't hold them well or sometimes other people trespass our boundaries. So when anger does arise, we either go into one of two main camps with our anger. We express our anger in an unhealthy way. So we get over-identified with our anger. We fuse with our anger. Or we try to suppress our anger. We try to bypass it. Or we try to morph it into more convenient or comfortable emotions, like sadness, depression, give up. So those are two reactive things we tend to do with our anger. But when we can come into balance, into a healthy relationship with our anger, we can really mine the gems, the wisdom it has to offer us, and come more into our power and take appropriate action. So this is what we're going to be exploring today. But how do we do this? Well, this is where mindfulness comes in. Mindfulness is the most important tool to support us in creating this balanced, healthy relationship with anger. So what we're going to be exploring today, to start, we are going to be unpacking anger, getting to know what it is, clarifying what it's also not. And we're going to be exploring the neuroscience of anger, what's happening in our brain, what's happening in our physiology when anger is here. We're also going to be generating some greater understanding for our anger, exploring your own personal relationship with it, your history with it, and what happens in your body when it arises. And we're also going to be using some mindfulness practices to help you come into greater balance and harmony with it. So I have a few goals for us today. And one of the goals is to support you in just at the very basic level, having a deeper understanding of what anger is. A second goal is to support you in creating a healthier relationship with this emotion, and maybe even possibly an appreciation for it, for the gems it has to offer you. So normally when anger arises, in the fire and heat and passion of it, we can't see clearly. The waters are muddied. And so using mindfulness, which is really a tool to help us see clearly, we can better get to those gems of wisdom that our anger is trying to share with us. So I have a few goals for this section for today. And so one of the goals is really to start to help you to create a deeper understanding of what anger really is. A second goal that I have for today is to help you create a healthier relationship with your own anger and maybe even an appreciation for the gems it has to offer you. And the last goal I have for this section is really to help you come into greater balance with this relationship, as I shared a little bit before. And there's a great quote that I really appreciate that illustrates this point. Anger is like a child. You don't want to let it drive the car, but you certainly don't want to stuff it in the trunk either. So for me, when anger comes up, I like to use this metaphor to slow things down and really ask myself, hey, Juna, who's driving the car right now? Is my anger driving the car or am I driving the car? Or, hey, Juna, am I stuffing my anger in the trunk right now? Because I want her to be actually in the passenger seat or the back seat with me. So this might be a helpful quote for you as we're going along in this section today. So let's start by unpacking anger a little bit here. There's some stereotypes about anger, and those can really influence how we view this emotion. So I want you to think right now, what are some of the stereotypes that you have about this emotion? When you hear the word anger, what comes to mind for you? And so you might be thinking right now, it's ugly. This is a bad emotion. This is a wrong emotion. Maybe you're thinking it's unenlightened, it's kind of primitive. Maybe you're thinking it's even unfeminine. So these are some of the things that we tend to think of when we hear that word, anger. So where do we get some of these stereotypes about anger? We get them from our families growing up. We get them in school. We get them from our religions, from the society we grew up in. We get them from the media. And again, I share all this just to help us really see some of these stereotypes really color and influence our perspective of this emotion. So another question I have for you. Have you ever asked someone, "Are you angry right now?" Only to have them respond with, "No, no, no, I'm not angry. I'm just a little annoyed." So what I would offer is that that is actually anger light. So words like annoyed, irritated, frustrated, I'm irked right now, all of those are anger. They're just a lighter version of anger. But sometimes it can feel a little easier, more comfortable to use those words. And then there's also anger heavy, which encompasses words like rage, aggression, hate, wrath, hostility. And all of these are actually words to describe the same thing, anger. So what is anger really? What is really the essence of this emotion? So in a moment, we're going to be diving into exploring what anger is. But before we do that, I want to give you a felt experience of meeting this emotion, contacting it in your body, so that we're not going to color any of what you're going to experience with any of the content I'm going to share. So what I'm going to invite you to do is go ahead and get in a comfortable seated position. Just start by taking some slow, deep breaths throughout your whole body right now. Feeling maybe your feet on the floor and your sits bones in, making contact with your chair or cushion. Just really coming into this present moment right now. And as you're ready, closing your eyes. Noticing the sounds in the room around you, in the space. And we're going to be generating some of the themes of mindfulness as we go into this practice. And so some of those themes are going to be opening to some, having some curiosity, generating some compassion for our experience, practicing non-judgment for whatever arises, even if it's uncomfortable, and it might be. And so to start here, I'm going to count to three, and I'm going to say a word, and I'm going to invite you to notice what's arising in your body. What sensations are bubbling up? Where are they arising? What's going on for you? And seeing if you can hold all that's happening with compassion, with non-judgment. One, two, three. Anger. Taking some deep, slow breaths. Just noticing what is here. What's bubbling up inside of you? Even if it's nothing at all. And again, on the count of three, I'm going to say a sentence. And you're going to do the very same thing. You're just going to notice what arises. One, two, three. I feel angry. Taking some deep breaths throughout your whole body. And just noticing what is here. Now again, this time you're going to actually be saying some of these statements. And as you say them out loud or to yourself, I'm going to have you notice what is here, what arises. So on the count of three, I'm going to have you say anger. And again, notice what happens inside your body. One, two, three, anger. Taking some deep, slow breaths, relaxing your shoulders. And on the count of three, I'm going to have you say, I feel angry. Again, noticing what's here. And see if you can say it with a little bit of force. One, two, three. I feel angry. Using mindfulness, using this compassionate, non-judgmental awareness to notice what is happening. And we have one last part of this exercise. For a moment here, just really come into your body, pressing your feet into the ground, feeling your sits bones in your seat. Breathing through the whole length of your body, letting your breath really massage your insides. You're doing a beautiful job here. This is not easy work. And for this final piece, I want you to imagine that anger, the essence of anger, is standing out in front of you. Maybe about 10 feet away. And this isn't the stereotypical version of anger. This is really the core of it, what anger truly is. So go ahead and see it out in front of you and take some deep breaths, just noticing how it shows up for you. And see if you can not judge how it's showing itself to you. You can really hold all of it with an open mind, breathing and staying curious. And we're going to imagine for a moment that you can actually talk to your anger and ask it some questions. And we're going to imagine that your anger can actually speak to you. So the first question for your anger is, anger, what are you? What are you? And really open to anything it wants to share with you. It might be in the form of words, images, feelings, just opening to what arises. Continuing to breathe. Then one final question here for your anger. And again, just imagining it can speak to you. It can share with you. The last question is, anger, what is one thing you most want me to know right now? What is one thing you most want me to know right now? Just taking some final deep breath through your body. Again, wiggling your toes, pressing your feet into the ground. And as you're ready, you can begin to open your eyes. Thank you so much for doing that practice. I know it's not easy to dive right in like that, especially into such an uncomfortable emotion like anger. So I really appreciate your willingness. And now what I'd love for you to do is take some time to actually journal about some of the things that you discovered here. So in a moment, you're going to pause and journal on the following questions. And the first one is, when I said anger, when I said I feel angry, what arose for you? What sensations did you notice in your body? Where were they? Were you able to stay with yourself? The second one is, when you said anger, when you said, I feel angry, how was that for you? What arose for you? Again, where did you maybe feel your anger? Or was it hard to really stay with yourself in that? Was it hard to not judge your experience? And again, all of this is data. We're just documenting what you found, what you discovered. And the final piece to journal about is, when you met your anger, what did it look like? What did it tell you that it was? And what did it say to you that it most wanted you to know? So go ahead and pause and take some time to journal and reflect on your experience, and then we'll come back together. So part of creating a relationship with anger is really taking the time to get to know it. And you are doing that right now, even through doing some of these journaling exercises. So I asked you some different questions, and I just want to reflect a little bit about what participants in the past have shared, or even clients of mine have shared when they've done some of these exercises. So in the past, when people said, I feel angry, they would notice tension in their shoulders, in the back of the neck, the jaw, sometimes even in their fists. So anger tends to reside in these areas of the body. And in my experience, it can also cause issues in these areas. So undigested anger, unmetabolized anger, can actually cause issues in our body that hang around. And being someone who had chronic TMJ, acid reflux, and neck issues, yes, I can say that I can certainly attest that this certainly happens. When people asked anger, what are you? They heard the words protection. They heard the words boundary. Some people got really afraid when they met their anger, and they felt themselves dissociating, leaving their body a little bit during the meditation. Other people enjoyed meeting their anger. So these are just some of the things that might have arisen for you as you did this exercise. So now we're going to take some time to actually explore what anger is. So as we shared already, anger is protection of self, other, or that which we care for most. Anger is our boundaries. And I would also say that anger is our unclaimed power, our right to be here, to have a voice, to take a stand for the things we care for most. And as we dive into exploring anger a little bit more, I want to share a little story with you. Thich Nhat Hanh is a Vietnamese Buddhist monk and a world-renowned mindfulness teacher. And he was sitting up on stage asking the audience to some different questions, and then they were asking some questions of him. And this little cute little girl raised her hand, and he called on her, and she looked really troubled, and she said, how do I get rid of my anger? And he looked down at her, and he said, anger is like the mud, and you cannot grow the lotus flower without the mud. And the lotus flower represents our joy, our love, our happiness. And so what he basically said to her is, it's not about getting rid of our anger. Instead, it's really about creating more of a relationship with this emotion, understanding this emotion, getting to know it and learning to sit with it, even in the discomfort of it. Because when we do that, we support the growth of the lotus flower, which is our joy, our love, our heart. And so I appreciate this story because, as I'll share in a little bit, that was not my perspective of anger at all growing up. I was much more similar to that little girl. Carla McLaren wrote the book, The Language of Emotions, and she has a beautiful quote about anger. She says, anger is a mix between a stalwart castle sentry and an ancient sage. Anger sets your boundaries by walking the perimeter of your soul and keeping an eye on you, the people around you, and your environment. If your boundaries are broken by the insensitivity of others or in any other way, anger comes forward to restore your sense of strength and separateness. The questions for anger are, what must be protected? What must be restored? So I really appreciate this quote by Carla McLaren, and those questions have stayed with me. So just like that quote about the car and not wanting anger to drive the car or putting it in the trunk, these two questions are also questions I use and I use with clients and in my lectures. What must be protected? What must be restored? These are really helpful ways to slow us down and actually come into contact with the anger that's here in this moment, again, mining the gems it might have to offer us. There are many gifts that anger can offer us. And again, it can be sometimes hard to see this, but it's also really important to illustrate. So anger can illuminate, as I said before, our boundaries, our authentic no, and our unclaimed power. Another gift of anger is that it can inspire us into action to take a stand for the things we care for most. If we feel that there's some kind of injustice happening, anger is that motivating energy to take action, to start a movement, to make a change. One of my colleagues also calls anger destroy for love. And I really appreciate this idea of anger. I kind of imagine the Hindu goddess Kali with her big, huge sword. And she's cutting through illusion. She's cutting through things that no longer are serving because we love ourselves so much. We love our freedom, our joy so much. So anger can also inspire us to end a relationship, to end a job, to end something, to eliminate something, to destroy something that's no longer good for us. Tara Brach also calls anger discriminating wisdom. So one of the ways that we can look at anger is that it helps us actually see clearly. It helps us actually know something's fishy here. Something's a little off here. And I'm going to listen to this. There's a wisdom in anger. And Carla McLaren says that anger is the healing of trauma. And this was an interesting one for me because this is something that I've certainly experienced. So the inner roar of anger has this ability, this capacity to actually thaw us out of the freeze, the dissociated state that we're in as a result of trauma. When our psyche, our soul feels us here with ourselves, advocating for ourselves, fiercely taking a stand for ourselves, maybe for the first time in our lives, this anger actually helps us come home to ourselves more fully into our bodies. So these are some of the gifts here of anger that I wanted to share with all of you. I didn't always see these gifts. In fact, I might have been a little bit more like you and certainly like that little girl with Thich Nhat Hanh, where I thought anger was something that is bad to be gotten rid of. And what I'd like to share with you is a story from my past, something I've experienced, and it's a little vulnerable to share, but it also feels important because it helps you see why I have such a passion for sharing the wisdom of this emotion. So I grew up as a good girl. I grew up with a loving, amazing family, and my mom was also the quintessential gold star earning good girl, and I really enjoyed the benefits of being a good girl. People like good girls. But growing up, I think one of the things that I can see now that shaped my inner good girl was growing up with a father who's an amazing man, an inspiring man, a loving man, but he also had a really unhealthy relationship with his anger. So in our household growing up, sometimes he would just erupt in a fit of anger. He was never physically violent, but he would yell and he would scream. And I never quite knew when he was gonna get set off. Sometimes it would be from maybe going into the kitchen and leaving a cupboard open. Maybe it would be because I left something on the hallway floor. But suddenly he'd be yelling. And his yells terrified me. Being an empathic child, a sensitive child, I think that they were extra scary for me. I remember being maybe about 10 years old and sitting in a restaurant with my family. And my dad started to yell at the waiter for serving him warm red wine. And the waiter started to cry. And I actually remember sitting back in my chair and quietly vowing to myself that I would never, ever do anger. I thought anger was ugly and bad and a primitive emotion, and it only just did bad things. It only hurt people. So that was a significant moment where I chose to adopt a personality much more similar to my mom's and chose not to do any of that ugly, bad anger stuff like my dad. So growing up as a good girl, there was many benefits to it. I was liked, I smiled, people enjoyed me, and this coping strategy worked for a while. People tend to like us good girls. But it hit a point where it wasn't starting to work anymore. I remember in college starting to get some feedback from people where they said, "Juna, I really like you, but I feel like you're a little fake, or I don't really know if I trust you when you tell me what you're feeling or what you're really thinking." And I was horrified. What? But I thought I'm doing everything right. I didn't know how to show up differently. So this is the way life works sometimes, and maybe you've experienced this yourself, but at a certain point, we'll create something big enough, hard enough, to help us actually see that the strategies we're using are really, truly not working for us anymore. And that's what I created with my own inner good girl. I didn't have a sense of my boundaries. I didn't have enough of a sense of self, because my largest commitment in this life was to being good, to doing it right, and to maintaining connection above all else. So at a certain point in my late 20s, I got into a relationship. I started dating this amazing, charismatic, really smart man. And I fell head over heels in love with him. And then I started to lose myself. And then I started to second guess myself. But the love was so good and the relationship was so amazing, and I didn't really pay attention to those other things. It got to a point in that relationship where I had fully lost myself. And any time I tried to hold my boundaries, I was punished. And it wasn't physical abuse, which is somebody's hitting you. It was psychological abuse, where he would overtly withdraw his attention, his love, his adoration of me, sometimes for hours, sometimes for days. Now, who doesn't do this in relationship? We love someone, they do something that triggers us, we pull away because we're hurt. Well, there's a big difference between that and strategic, systematic, regular, kind of in a way, pulling away our attention as a way of training someone to a certain way of being. I started to recognize I was on hyper alert, to always want to do whatever he wanted me to do in order to maintain the love and connection above all else. So year three of that relationship, something began to happen. And for those of you who live in California or earthquake country, you might know this, but when an earthquake is coming, sometimes you can actually hear it before the earth has started to shake. And this is what started to happen in my being. I started to almost feel an earthquake was coming. And I didn't know what it was, but it terrified me. And that last year of our relationship, I remember saying to him, "I feel like a volcano is about to explode. I feel like something's happening inside of me, and I don't know what it is, and it's really scaring me." And when my inner earthquake finally came, my volcano blew up. I broke up with him, which was terrifying, and I was seething. I was fuming with anger. My anger was so, so mad at him, at myself, for all the ways I had trespassed myself in that relationship. And there was some pretty acute and significant ways. And then my anger rose again to show me it was so angry at all the ways I had trespassed myself my entire life. And this anger was uncomfortable. It was really the first time in my life I was actually feeling anger, and I wanted to make this emotion go away. I wanted to do whatever I could just to get rid of this emotion, but it wouldn't go away. In fact, it got larger even after the breakup. And so I'd go on walks, I'd journal, how do I get rid of this anger? Someone tell me what to do. Nothing was happening. Nothing was changing the situation. So months later, maybe even a year later, it wasn't until I actually started to turn towards my anger, to really face it, just like you've done here today, and to actually create a relationship with it, that it began to show me things, it began to tell me things. I began to come back home into myself. I began to see all the ways I had left myself, trespassing my own boundaries, not listening to my authentic yes, my authentic no, allowing other people to trespass my boundaries. All of this just started to become super clear, and finally, my anger began to move. And this was a really powerful time, not comfortable, very, very uncomfortable, in fact, and one of the most significant experiences of my life, because for the first time, I was coming home to me. For the first time, I felt like I had a voice. For the first time, I learned how to be in my body. I didn't have to be dissociated, kind of hovering above my body, sweetly smiling all the time. So this was a really powerful experience and has really informed how I show up in the world, how I communicate in the world. And it was also a challenging experience. And there was some messy parts of it as well. So anger is not a clean emotion. It can be very messy, but it's really important to recognize that that's a phase. And as we apply mindfulness to this emotion, as we apply really taking the time to get to know this emotion, we begin to come into right relationship with it. So some of these tools, some of these techniques that we're using today are the very same ones I use with my clients who also have had a challenging relationship with anger, where either they stuffed it consistently, or they were only able to feel sadness instead of anger, or, as I said before, they overly fuse with it, overly identify with it. Thank you so much for hearing my story. It's definitely vulnerable to share, and it also feels important. So now I'm going to invite you to journal and reflect on your own relationship with anger. And in a moment, you can pause this and take some time to journal and create a little bit of a deeper understanding of your history and even your current experience of anger. So the first question is, what experiences from childhood and beyond have shaped and informed your current view of anger? Number two, how would you describe your current relationship with anger? What do you do or don't do when you feel angry, when others feel angry? Number three, what is the scariest thing about creating a deeper relationship with your anger? And the last question, number four, describe your ideal relationship with anger. What would it look like to have a healthy relationship with this emotion? And how might this impact your relationships, your health, your work? So go ahead and take some time to journal on these four different questions, and then we'll come back together and do a little bit of reflection.
Lecture 8, Getting to Know Your Anger.
Thank you for taking the time to journal on these questions. And one thing I'm going to really welcome you to do is to continue to ask yourself some of these questions. You know, what experiences from my past really have impacted me here? And what is the scariest thing for me about deepening with anger? So as you continue on this journey of creating more of a relationship with this emotion, you might notice some of these fears that you've written down today start to bubble up. And now that you've really isolated them, you can more fully see them and choose whether they influence your experience or not. So now we're going to be going into exploring a little bit more about anger, the neuroscience of anger, and then leading you through another mindfulness practice to support you in deepening your relationship with anger. So to start here, what I would offer you is that there is the pure emotion of anger, and then there are all the things that we do with our anger. And these are not the same thing. So anger arises, and then there are actual things we choose to do with our anger. There are actual avenues we choose to channel our anger into that are not anger. But anger itself is so often conflated with all the things we do with it because out of all the emotions, it has the strongest impetus to act. And we'll be exploring that a little bit further as we go into the neuroscience. But first, I want to tease apart this point here. So anger and aggression are not the same thing. Anger and hate, anger and violence are not the same thing. Anger arises and we can choose to express it in an unhealthy way, or we can also choose to suppress it. And both of these are unhealthy versions of relating to anger. So anger arises and I can channel my anger into aggression, where I dehumanize others. I can channel my anger into bullying. I can channel my anger into hate or violence. And anger also arises and I can suppress this emotion. So I can actually just sit on my anger. I can stuff it under the rug. Or I can morph it even to more convenient emotions like sadness, depression, give up, as I said before. So those are all unhealthy things that I can do with my anger. And what you'll notice is when you go in that direction of doing some of these more unhealthy things with anger, unhealthy expression or suppressing it, you tend to actually recycle the emotion anger. It's almost like putting your anger in the washing machine and spinning it again and again and again. You don't actually support yourself in moving all the way through this emotion. It just tends to linger. So another version of doing anger is anger can arise and we pause. We take a deep breath. We meditate with it. We go on a walk with it. Maybe we journal. Maybe we get in our car and we just let ourselves speak or yell or move some of the energy, but we're doing it maybe in a safer space. Anger might arise and we mindfully attend to it. Maybe we get curious with it and we ask it some questions like you've done today. So all of these are healthier ways of expressing our anger and also being with our anger. And what you may notice when you are with your anger in these kinds of ways, you support the emotion in moving all the way through you. I like to imagine emotions are like a wave. They rise, they hit a peak, and they fall. And some research has shown that emotions tend to not actually last longer than about 90 seconds if we don't feed them with our thoughts. So again, when you attend to your anger in these healthy ways, being with the emotion, expressing the emotion in a healthy way, you support the rise and fall of this emotion, and then you can come back into greater presence with yourself. And what this supports you in doing is then taking action that's congruent with the situation at hand, appropriate action. So this is a little bit here about what it's like to be with anger and channel it either in unhealthy ways or healthy ways. So why is anger so often conflated with all the things we do with it? Well, as I said, Anger has the strongest impetus to act of all the emotions. So of course it's seen as violent or rage or hate. But now what I want to do is deepen our understanding of that a little bit more. And we're going to start by looking at the brain and the neuroscience of anger. The human brain is often called the triune brain because it's broken up into three main parts.